BBC World Service, this is Razia Iqbal with NewsHour. Coming up, ISIS declares a caliphate in territory it controls in Iraq and Syria. We explore what that means for the region. A year on since demonstrations in Egypt led to the downfall of Mohamed Morsi and the election of President Sisi.
The brutality with which this regime is going after any voice of opposition is something that makes Mubarak look like a dove, an angel by comparison.
The athlete Oscar Pistorius is back in court having had his mental health evaluated.
Mr. Pistorius did not suffer from a mental defect or mental illness at the time of the commission of the offence that would have rendered him criminally not responsible for the offences.
First, let's have a bulletin of world news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The Italian Navy has found the bodies of 30 migrants in a fishing boat packed with almost 600 people. They'd been crammed into a small hold and are believed to have either suffocated or drowned. Stefano Framori is the commander of the Navy ship which located the vessel. He told the BBC what they found.
You must think about a fishing boat of 20 metres, really full of people. At the end, we conducted an inspection and we found through a hatch a place inside the fishing boat where lied around 30 bodies. Maybe there are more, but it's very difficult to go inside and have a better count.
It's becoming a record year of migrations across the Mediterranean. More than 5,000 migrants were rescued on the crossing from North Africa in the past 48 hours. The trial of Oscar Pistorius has heard that the athlete didn't suffer from a mental illness or disorder at the time his girlfriend was shot. The trial is scheduled to last a further 2 weeks. Andrew Harding is following the proceedings.
The panel of experts spent a month evaluating Oscar Pistorius after his own psychiatrist had said he suffered from an anxiety disorder. Today the trial heard two short segments from the new reports, both stating that the athlete had no mental illness and that he would have known right from wrong the night he killed Rivas Steenkamp. Mr. Pistorius's own doctor, a defence witness, then described in detail the impact of the athlete's disability. Without his prosthetic legs, Mr. Pistorius struggled to balance, was often in pain, and was extremely vulnerable.
Scientists say that for the first time, Indonesia is cutting down more trees each year than Brazil. An American study estimates that the country has cleared 60,000 square kilometres of virgin forest, an area almost as big as Ireland, since the start of the century. The researchers said that deforestation has led to an increase in greenhouse gas emissions and a loss of biodiversity. Loggers continue to cut down trees in Indonesia, despite a ban on clearing primary forest. The Pakistani military says it's launched a ground offensive in the North Waziristan tribal area, which borders Afghanistan. Officials said the assault marked a new phase in the government's operation against Taliban militants in the region. From Islamabad, here's Andrew North.
The deadly assault on Karachi Airport was seen as the last straw by many here after years of violent attacks inside Pakistan by militants who had at times been tolerated by its military. And for the past 2 weeks, Pakistani forces have been carrying out airstrikes against what it says are militant hideouts in the tribal area of North Waziristan. Now the military says a ground operation has begun, with infantry units searching areas around Miran Shah, the main town in North Waziristan. But there are widespread reports from within North Waziristan that many militants were allowed to escape before the operation began.
You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. Residents of Tikrit in Iraq say heavy fighting is taking place in the southern outskirts of the city as Iraqi security forces continue their offensive against Sunni militants. Eyewitnesses are reporting a wave of government airstrikes on targets across the city. On Sunday, the Sunni insurgent group ISIS proclaimed its leader as ruler of all Muslims. Clashes are reported to be continuing in a town on the border between Syria and Iraq, between ISIS and the Nusra Front, an al-Qaeda-affiliated rebel group. It's the latest instance of infighting between the groups, which Syrian activists say has claimed 7,000 lives this year. French police, investigating allegations of influence peddling and breaches of confidence, have detained a lawyer for the former president, Nicolas Sarkozy, along with a magistrate. French judicial officials say intercepted telephone calls between the lawyer and Mr. Sarkozy on an undeclared mobile revealed that information on the investigation was being passed to the lawyer in return for the promise of political favours. Christian Fraser reports from Paris.
According to French newspaper Le Monde, the judicial bugging of Mr. Sarkozy's phone started in April last year. It's alleged the phone taps uncovered attempts by the lawyer Thierry Herzog to obtain secret information on the judicial investigations that were being mounted against the former president. Investigators suspect that in return for this insider information, Mr. Sarkozy was trying to secure a gilded retirement post in Monaco for one of the most senior judges in the Court of Appeal, Gilbert Azibert, who was also called in today for questioning.
China says a senior retired army general, who is also a member of the Communist Party's Politburo, is being investigated for corruption. China's president, Xi Jinping, personally approved the move to investigate Xu Zaiho, who's accused of accepting bribes and promoting his friends and associates. Rumours about the investigation into General Xu have circulated for some months. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Razia Iqbal with NewsHour. Coming up today, we'll be live in Toronto, Canada, as the city's troubled mayor goes back to work.
Yes, I have smoked crack cocaine. Am I an addict? No.
When have you?
Have I tried it? Probably in one of my drunken stupors, probably approximately about a year ago. All I can do now is apologize and move on. I don't know what I'll... Oh, guys, okay, can I...
And could creating vaccines from caged chimps be their wild cousins' only hope of survival?
I'm a conservationist who got into this because I love these animals. I mean, I hate seeing them in a cage. I don't like seeing them in a cage. It bums me out. But the fact is, unless we do this, those animals are going to go extinct in the wild.
Stay with us for those reports, but first the Middle East, and specifically Iraq and Syria. It is a red letter week for the Islamist militant group ISIS. Not only has the group declared the restoration of the Caliphate in territory it controls in Iraq and Syria, but it's changed its name to the Islamic State. We'll continue to refer to it as ISIS for now. There are huge implications of this Caliphate declaration for the wider region, and we'll discuss that in just a moment. But first, let's hear it from the horse's mouth. The spokesman for ISIS announces that the territory they control will be governed in accordance with its interpretation of Islamic law. Let's hear from Sheikh Abu Muhammad al-Adnani al-Ashami's statement, which was posted on YouTube.
بعد أن باتت الدولة الإسلامية بفضل الله تمتلك كل مقومات الخلافة.
Well, there it is, the declaration of a caliphate. Well, on the ground, the youthful army of ISIS continues to engage in heavy fighting on the southern outskirts of Tikrit. Eyewitnesses report a wave of government airstrikes on targets across the city, including one on Saddam Hussein's former palaces. Let's talk first to our reporter Murad Shishani in the northern city of Erbil. Murad, you're in Erbil, but what can you tell us about the reports of the continuing fighting around Tikrit?
Yesterday, since late after the fasting break, as they call it, you know, this is the Ramadan month now here. It's a fasting month for Muslim people. And since the breaking fast after the sunset, the fighting started from our resources, as we understood, started in the outskirts of Tikrit. And both parties, while the government saying that they will keep the offensive on until they control the city, the Sunni rebels, through our sources, told us that they pushed them back and they are still on control. The conflicted reports still coming on, but they are around this issue that both are claiming they are controlling, but it seems that the Sunni rebels have pushed the governmental forces back. However, the offensive of the government troops are increasing from now on. That's what we've heard. And here in Erbil, we usually use the flow of the displaced people as an indicator to see how the things are going inside Iraq. But in the last 2 days, the flow was a normal rate. So we can't say that caused more damage for civilians inside Iraq.
And Murad, has there been any reaction yet to the announcement yesterday by ISIS of the formation of the caliphate?
As we recall, in 2007, one of the major issues between that triggered the clashes between the Sunni community and the ISIS, which was at the Islamic State of Iraq at that time, when it changed its name from Al-Qaeda in Iraq to Islamic State, was the announcement of that Islamic State of Khilafat, as described today. So, but today, Sunni forces and Sunni persons, spoke to them in the last 2-3 days, they were insisting that ISIS is not dominating and they don't have the upper hand. However, now they need to explain themselves how they could accept now what's going on, because they kept saying, no, it's ISIS don't have this upper hand. Now they had announced clearly the Islamic State, and obviously it seems they are controlling huge geographical spaces.
Okay, Murad Shishani speaking to us on not a great line from Erbil. We're grateful to you. Let's talk now, though, about the implications of the actual declaration of a caliphate in the territory currently held by ISIS, which amounts to parts of northern Iraq and the Syrian town of Raqqa. I'm joined in our Oxford studio by two people who know a great deal about both Islam and what's happening in Iraq at the moment, the Iraqi journalist Mina Al-Oraibi and the academic Tariq Ramadan. The implications span both ideology and theology. So let's start with some definitions. Tariq Ramadan, what is a caliphate? Explain that.
Look, the caliphate is a concept that is coming back to the Islamic tradition, and that is the Islamic government, what we call an Islamic state, that goes beyond the national borders. So this is why now they are coming with this, because the Islamic state was for Iraq. Now that as they are talking about Syria, they are saying it's expanding. So the reference and the right reference in Islamic tradition would be the caliphate. Al-Khilafa, in fact, in the Arabic word. And once again, they are playing here with a concept that could attract some of the people who are now resisting, or they think that they're resisting to foreign presence, and also the Shia, because they are also playing the Sunni against the Shia rhetoric that we knew for the last years.
Mina Al-Oraibi, what's your assessment of how significant this is in the context of Iraq and Syria, since the assumption is that the boundaries have been eroded between those two countries?
Absolutely. It's much more a propaganda tool than an actual difference in how ISIS or the militants will actually be carrying out, whether it's their attacks or trying to hold the territory that they have. It's about saying that we are able to bring in parts of Syria, parts of Iraq, and expand to other parts of the region in this caliphate that, again, is their way of saying we don't recognize any of these borders. It's also important, as your correspondent was saying, for them to try to say that they are the ultimate authority on the ground. There are different Sunni groups fighting, whether it's in Mosul or Tikrit or Anbar, who don't see Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi as their leader. And so we'll have to see if there is any infighting and how they react to this. So far, no one has pledged allegiance to him.
Tariq Ramadan, is it possible just to declare yourself supreme leader of all Muslims in the way that he clearly has appeared to have done?
No, you can't do that. But of course, once again, he has supporters, and what is happening on the ground is exactly what was said right now. It's just a propaganda, a PR exercise, saying we are here, we are strong, we are controlling the northern Iraq and northern Syria. And then through this, the problem is that now we need the Sunni to come with a clear positioning on this, to keep on repeating they are not there, they are not controlling, and what we see now, this assertiveness that they have, means that beyond the division between Sunni and Shia, what is necessary now, it's also to come with a clear positioning saying this has nothing to do with the future of the region, this is completely wrong, this has nothing to do with the Islamic tradition. What is also to be said here is that foreign powers should be clearer on the way they are involved in this, because the Americans, by, for example, not helping the Maliki government while they were saying we are going to help, and then withdrawing, saying we wait for the fall, and having Russia. So Russia and the States are united as to Iraq and divided as to Syria. This is a complete mess. There is no consistency in the policies that we are seeing in the region now.
But isn't it possible that very mess that you talk about, the lack lack of consistency from the outside world could actually play into the hands of ISIS. You know, you've both talked about it being a propaganda war, but it could potentially become a rallying cry, couldn't it, because of its kind of potent symbolism and historical rootedness?
Absolutely, it is a rallying cry. I mean, when I say propaganda tool, it's not in any way to speak of it as less important or not something that requires real urgency to deal with. These are people's lives on the ground. You're seeing the numbers of the hundreds of thousands of displaced Iraqis and also Syrians who are fleeing the fighting. So by no means is it just to say they're just changing the name and that's it. But what I'm trying to say, and I think the importance of saying it's a propaganda tool, is exactly the point that they can get young men to rally around this, to say that we are the only way that you are going to have a Muslim state in the region. We've seen what's been happening in the last 2-3 years, where a lot of Islamic political parties who were taking the political route were completely discredited, and so, or not given a chance to rule. And so what's happened is that you see the other side where, okay, with guns, we are enforcing our presence. We're actually able to demolish borders between countries.
That's pretty potent in and of itself, isn't it, Tariq Ramadan? Because what they're doing, we go back to the beginning of our conversation, which is that it's a challenge to other Muslim groups, isn't it?
Yes, of course, that's a challenge, because the discourse should be clear on the fact that you can be for liberation of Iraq in a way which is based on what the Iraqi people want and what the Syrian people want. At the same time, you cannot support and you cannot be silent when you have people using all the inconsistent positioning and policies, for example, coming from the West or coming from within, and to do whatever they are doing and killing people because they are violent extremist people on the ground. So the positioning from Muslims should be clear. But once again, get it as it has to be gotten in this discussion. The West is not helping in any ways in the way they are dealing. And when you listen to Israel saying that we need to create a Kurdish independent state, this is exactly the rhetoric that is going to help these people. This is exactly what they want. So if we are not consistent in the way we are supporting people in the democratic way and the democratic policy, whatever is the result, if we don't agree with what the people are choosing, we still need to support the democratic processes. And by not being clear on this, this is what we get.
Mina, do you, when you talk about a rallying cry for young Muslims, do you expect that, given that al-Baghdadi claims to be a descendant of Prophet Muhammad's tribe, the Qurayshi tribe, that actually it could result in young Westerners going wanting to become much more a part of ISIS? We know that there are lots of young fighters from the United Kingdom who've gone.
Well, al-Baghdadi is not the first of leaders in the region to falsely claim to have direct descent from the Prophet to try to get legitimacy that way. And I think it's a very important not to fall into the trap of saying that actually gives him any sort of legitimacy. But again, it shows how he's trying to position himself, and these different militants are trying to position ISIS as having some sort of Islamic legitimacy that they actually don't have. To be a Khalifa, there are so many requirements that he lacks, whether it's from actual knowledge of Islam and the level that he's reached in that, in the piety, and of course not killing, not having blood on your hands. But moving on to the issue of course, how it affects mainly young men, but others, in feeling that this is a cause that we can fight for, the ideal of having a truly Muslim state and in what it represents in giving people equality and justice and fairness. However, ISIS does not espouse any of those values, and okay, it's trying to bridge that gap.
Okay. Iraqi journalist Mina Al-Uraibi and the academic Tariq Ramadan, thanks both for joining us. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Now, the trial of Oscar Pistorius has resumed in Pretoria, with experts saying they had found no sign of mental illness after a month of psychiatric tests. The prosecutor, Jerry Nell, read from the psychologist report.
Mr. Pistorius did not suffer from a mental defect or mental illness at the time of the commission of the offence that would have rendered him criminally not responsible for the offences charged. 6.2. Mr. Pistorius was capable of appreciating the wrongfulness of his act and of acting in accordance with an appreciation of the wrongfulness of his act.
So that's Jerry Nail reading from the psychologist's report on the mental health evaluation done on Oscar Pistorius, which is why the trial was in recess. Let's talk now to Professor James Grant, an expert on South African criminal law at Wits University. Professor Grant, give us your reaction to the outcome of this psychologist's report.
It's not surprising. It's in our law, although we lack a definition of mental illness or defect, which is a legal concept, our law has to date not recognized the psychological disorder of generalized anxiety disorder as the legal concept mental illness or defect. And so it was to be expected that this wasn't going to be recognized by a review board of psychiatrists as the legally significant condition.
So in your view, it was a risk on the part of the defense to ask for this evaluation?
I don't think it was a risk. I think that Gerry Nel, the prosecutor, recognized that in the testimony of Dr. Foster, called on behalf of Oscar Pistorius, she made certain allegations which in fact triggered the requirements under the Criminal Procedure Act for a court to refer a case for consideration. And in fact, Gerry Nel brought this to the attention of the court, and in the circumstances, the court had no discretion.
You say that it was brought to the attention of the court. How common is it that something like this would stop the court from continuing for the person in the doctor to have a mental health evaluation?
It's not common, but I suppose you would have, if you were trying to try and put a percentage to it, perhaps 5 to 10% of cases raise mental illness as a possible defence. But what is very unusual is for it to have been raised at this very late stage, and more particularly to have been raised by the prosecution. Usually, it's raised in defence of a person. In this case, as you know, it's been raised by the prosecution. The prosecution being bound, of course, by its duty to do justice, and also recognizing that if, of course, they didn't raise it at this point, it would have left the opportunity open for the defense later to raise it.
And do you think that the prosecution raised it because of the nature of the trial, because it's Oscar Pistorius and given his profile?
I think that what we have in this case is highly skilled legal practitioners. Certainly, we're seeing the best that the prosecuting service can possibly put up. And the defense has responded by calling amongst the best possible defense advocates. However, I don't think that they responded in a special way, given that they're dealing with Oscar Pistorius. I think that they're just doing their jobs, and they're doing their jobs properly.
Professor James Grant, an expert on South African criminal law, speaking to us from South Africa, expert at Wits University. Now, one of my favourite tweets during this World Cup football tournament came when the current champions were on their way to defeat. A wag said Spain had not been in this much trouble since that time when Ernest Hemingway tried to write a female character. Indeed, that Hemingway collection of short stories, Men Without Women, could easily be the tagline for the World Cup as a whole, on the pitch at least. There is a separate World Cup for women's football, of course, and the host nation usually does pretty well. So, what is the state of the women's game in the country? Is it an afterthought in a sport dominated by men? NewsHour's James Menendez is in Recife in Brazil's northeast.
Now, it's become something of a cliche, but the one thing you notice when you travel around Brazil is wherever you go, whether it's the beach, you're walking through a neighbourhood, or perhaps you're just walking past a school, is that people are playing football all the time. It happens everywhere. The other thing you notice is that very rarely those people playing football are women. In fact, almost never. I can't think of a single example where I've walked past someone having a kickabout in the street and there are women playing, either as part of a mixed team or on their own. You just don't see it. But Women's football does exist in Brazil. In fact, there's a very famous woman footballer, Marta, of course, who has become known throughout the world. Anyway, we thought it was a good opportunity to find out a bit more about the state of women's football in this country, and in particular in Recife. We've come down to a training ground just in the shadow of one of the city's main stadiums. It belongs to Sporti, which is, I think, the second biggest club in the city. And I'm with a couple of women's players who aren't actually from the same team, even though they've agreed to stand next to each other, and they're not going to fight. They are rivals, actually. Amanda's here, and she's from Vitória, which is, I think, is about 40 minutes away from Recife, which is the biggest women's football club in the state of Pernambuco, and Kaylee, who is from here, from Sporti. So this is her home turf. Amanda, let me just ask you first, when did you get involved in football? Well, at what age were you?
From the age of 8, playing with the kids in the street.
That's interesting, because I said in my introduction that you don't see women or girls, as you were then, playing in the streets. But it does happen, does it?
Yes, yes, especially in the neighbourhoods we grew up in. We'd play with the boys in the street, and that's how we learnt.
Kaylee, just come over here a second. Was that the same for you? What sort of age were you when you started kicking the ball about?
About the same. I was roughly 8 years old. We played in the street too. Originally, it was just in the dirt, but then they paved the streets and it sometimes hurt our feet, but we played anyway, and all the time.
And Amanda, you play for the most successful women's team in the state. What's life like as a professional woman footballer?
I'm really pleased to play for a club that's well known and one that can pay the players a salary and train us properly. They also helped with my education to get a degree. Now I think I'm going to do a postgraduate course too, and all thanks to football, so I'm very grateful.
Let's just go and talk to Eduardo Café, who's Amanda's coach at Vitória. So is it fair to say then that women's football isn't taken very seriously at all by lots of people in Brazil?
Yes, unfortunately it is true. Lots of people are prejudiced against women's football, but they don't know what it's really like. They don't understand how great it is to see women playing.
And why is that? Is that just because of Latin American machismo? I mean, is it just men being prejudiced in that way? They don't think women can play football? Honestamente.
Machismo, próprio realmente chamado preconceito, né?
Yes, it is machismo, and that's all there is to it. But we just have to hope that things change.
That was NewsHour's James Menendez in Recife. This is Razia Iqbal with NewsHour here in London. The controversial mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford, returns to work today. An excellent excuse, or you might argue feeble, to play 9 to 5 by the country music legend Dolly Parton. That was her performing in front of huge crowds yesterday at the world-famous Glastonbury Festival in the UK. We'll be going live to Toronto in about 30 minutes. And in tomorrow's programme, we will have an interview with the London-based artist Tracy Emin. I'll be speaking to her on the day her controversial work My Bed goes under the auctioneer's hammer. When it was first exhibited 15 years ago for the Turner Prize, the work, her actual unmade bed, complete with dirty sheets, dirty underwear, condoms, empty vodka bottles, the general detritus, which told the story of a woman in distress at the end of a relationship, provoked a furious debate about the nature of art. And she's been challenging boundaries in art ever since. And you can hear that interview with Tracy Emin on NewsHour tomorrow. Do stay with us with NewsHour today.
With bbc.com/news, you get the latest news stories anytime you like. bbc.com/news offers you the most comprehensive news coverage in the world, and its stories are easy to search and navigate. Whether you're interested in science, health, technology or business, the bbc.com/news website can offer it all. It also gives you the opportunity to listen live to our news output or check the latest breaking news with our minute-by-minute news feed. If you want to take the news with you, we offer you downloadable podcasts to listen at your convenience, or archive programming so you can catch up on the programmes you've missed. Or you can access bbc.com/news on your mobile phone. bbc.com/news also lets you give feedback direct to our programme teams. All this content, coverage and opportunity makes the BBC the world leader in news coverage online.
Coming up here on NewsHour in the next 30 minutes, 1 year since the overthrow of President Morsi, we'll be exploring the Egyptian military's role in fomenting popular protests, which led to the army seizing power. We'll also hear from the Italian government on the scale of the challenge they face as thousands of migrants make the perilous journey from Africa to the shores of Europe. Before that, though, let's have a summary of the latest world news.
BBC News with Marion Marshall. The Italian Navy has found the bodies of about 30 migrants in a fishing boat packed with almost 600 people. They'd been crammed into a small hold amid the engine fumes and may have been asphyxiated. The EU's Border Security Agency says 60,000 migrants have reached Italy so far this year. The trial of Oscar Pistorius has heard that the athlete didn't suffer from a mental illness at the time his girlfriend Reeva Steenkamp was shot. Proceedings have resumed in Pretoria after a six-week break, while psychiatric experts assess the defendant's mental health. Scientists say that for the first time, Indonesia is cutting down more trees each year than Brazil. An American study estimates that the country has cleared 60,000 square kilometres of virgin forest since the start of the century. The Pakistani military says it's launched a ground offensive against Taliban militants, believed to be sheltering in the North Waziristan tribal area, which borders Afghanistan. Troops are said to have begun a door-to-door search in and around the town of Miran Shah. It follows 2 weeks of airstrikes and artillery bombardment. China says a senior retired army general, who was also a member of the Communist Party's Politburo, is being investigated for corruption. General Xu is accused of accepting bribes and promoting his friends and associates, in a case the authorities describe as both serious and vile. Residents of Tikrit in Iraq say heavy fighting is taking place in the southern outskirts of the city, as Iraqi security forces continue their offensive against Sunni militants. Eyewitnesses are reporting a wave of government airstrikes on targets across the city. Two bombs have exploded near the presidential palace in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, killing two police officers. The attacks coincide with the first anniversary of the protests that led to the removal from power of the Islamist president, Mohamed Morsi. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Razia Iqbal. This is NewsHour. To Egypt now, and two bombs have exploded near the presidential palace in the capital, Cairo, killing two police officers. Let's go live to the BBC's Cairo reporter for the latest, Sally Nabil. Sally, I understand you've been to the sites of both of those bomb attacks. What did you see?
Yeah, I just came back. The situation there is pretty tense. We have lots of security forces and bomb experts. A very strict cordon has been imposed around the area. But it seems that this heavy security presence did not manage to protect the people from the bombs that went off. In fact, we had a couple of days ago, a militant group called Ajnad Misr, or Egypt's soldiers issued a statement warning that they have managed to implant a number of explosive devices around the presidential palace since the 18th of June. So we are speaking about more than 10 days now. Explosive devices have been implanted in the presidential palace. And the statement said, the statement was issued a couple of days ago. It said that security forces absolutely failed to locate where these bombs are. What we got from the security forces then was that the palace was absolutely clean and safe, but what happened today says that the warning of the militant group was absolutely right and that security forces did not take it seriously enough.
And who is this this group? Tell us a little bit more about them.
It's a militant group that claimed responsibility for a number of attacks before. Perhaps the most prominent attack was the blasts that rocked the Cairo University last April, killing one prominent police officer and injuring another. Actually, last May, a court issued a verdict classifying this group as a terrorist group. So we have this group that has been claiming responsibility for a number of attacks, and so far security forces have absolutely been unable to handle these successive attacks, if we can say. Though they got warning a couple of days ago, they didn't take it seriously enough, and here we have the result now: at least two police officers killed and five at least injured, one of them in a very, very critical condition.
And this is as a result of both, is that right? Those are the figures for both of those
yes,
bombs?
Yes, actually, and what we have seen also was that not all the bomb experts had the suitable and convenient gear to carry out their job correctly. We have a video that has gone viral on YouTube now and on the social media for one of the bomb experts in plain cloth without any gear or kit trying to look from a very close distance at the bomb just seconds before it went off. And what happened is that the bomb went off and he was killed.
Sally Nabil, live in Cairo, thanks very much. Well, a sign there of instability and division in Egypt. Those bomb attacks coincide with the first year since the protest that led to the removal of the Islamist president Mohamed Morsi. This was Tahrir Square in Cairo on June the 30th, 2013.
Asking for Morsi to leave, he and his gang. We asking for election, for parliament, and only for youth. Forget about the old guys. They're not good no more.
Today, just the beginning.
Well, millions of demonstrators took to the streets that day to demand President Morsi's removal. He was deposed 3 days later on the 3rd of July. So what happened to the grassroots movement known as Tamarod, which mobilised people onto the streets a year ago? In fact, the organisation managed to get 22 million signatures demanding that Morsi step down. And why do so many who joined those anti-government demonstrations now feel betrayed by the initiative's founders? Khalid Fahmy is a professor of history at the American University in Cairo. He supported the 2011 protest, now known as the January 25th Revolution, in Tahrir Square, which toppled Hosni Mubarak. And last year, he was out on the streets again with his parents, identifying with Tamarod's demands.
In the beginning, I thought this was a genuine grassroots organization, and Egypt has been seeing many, many such organizations. And this time, it finally clicked. But later on, and I have to admit, I wasn't quick enough to realize this, that this organization had been infiltrated by military intelligence and national security intelligence from a very early time. And now we have seen documents that have been published by bloggers, human rights activists, that show this connection between Tamarod and the security services from as early as March of 2013.
Indeed, one of the group's founders, Moheb Dos, admitted in an interview that his movement had been taking orders from the army. How did that make you feel once you discovered that?
I felt very betrayed, and I felt, I have to admit, very foolish that I didn't see the writing on the wall, that I should have questioned myself, because the logistics and the numbers and the statistics and the money involved in such a campaign, even just distributed photocopied leaflets, was such that should have made me realize that they could never have managed this on their own, that this is something that is orchestrated at a very, very high level, and this is something that involves a huge amount of money. And I stand by my decision to take to the streets on the 30th of June against the Muslim Brotherhood, but I never took to the streets and my friends with me asking for the military to step in. But this is what we now discover. The deal was, the deal that had been struck between the Tamarod campaign and the military, it wasn't simply to depose the Muslim Brotherhood rule, but to replace it by military rule.
Do you feel now, given that there has been another election and Sisi is now the president, that there is another dictator in the making?
This is a much more serious dictatorship than anything Egypt has witnessed over the past 60 years, because never before in modern Egyptian history has there been a president who controls so much power. Under Sisi now is the firm command of the military, military intelligence, security forces, the judiciary, and the police. Not even Nasser managed all of these strong points under his command in his height. And he also has enormous popularity and a very corrupt media that depicts the whole country as firmly behind him, when in fact the country is deeply divided, when in fact the cleavages in the country are very, very deep, because blood has been shed, serious blood has been shed. And the brutality with which this regime is going after any voice of opposition is something that makes Mubarak look like a dove, an angel by comparison.
That's an extraordinary comparison to make. What now then for dissent and protest? Because the protest law, which was enacted last year, prevents demonstrations without a police permit. Is it too dangerous now for people to go out onto the streets? Would you go out onto the streets?
No, it's very dangerous and it's very counterproductive. This is a contentious issue among revolutionaries. But yesterday I was in the courthouse that was trying the second round of demonstrators who were protesting against the anti-demonstration law. This is a draconian law that the government itself is not applying. Yesterday was a huge travesty of justice when the judge himself flouted the law both in substance and in procedures. No, it's a very difficult moment, but I think what we now realize is the depth of this very deep state, as we call it in Egypt, and the difficulties lying ahead. And we have now sobered up and realized that the struggle ahead is very, very long. This is something that will not be over in a year or two, or even a decade or two. And I think activists now are getting their act together and preparing for the very, very long run.
Given the euphoria of the January the 25th movement that led to Hosni Mubarak being overthrown, what hope do you have? You talk about it in the context of it being a long-term revolution, that it's not going to happen this year or next year. But what hope do you have, given what's at stake?
The Middle East, as we know it today, has been drawn and shaped by events taken during the 4 years of the First World War. The main thing that has happened since then, in my opinion, as a historian of the modern Middle East, is that for the first time, we hear the voice of the people. And this is a huge development in modern Middle East history. For the first time, the people are making their voices heard. And the challenge ahead of us now is to build institutions and to transform our energy into institutional structures, but mostly to reach out to our fellow citizens and to tell them that we are to be trusted not only in bringing down regimes, but also in the unenviable task of government. And that is what we are learning very, very gradually, but very surely as well.
That was Khalid Fahmy, Professor of History at the American University in Cairo. Lots more on Egypt on our website, bbc.com/news. Now, the World Health Organization has called on West African countries still free of the deadly Ebola virus to prepare for its possible arrival. Several hundred people have been killed by Ebola in Guinea, Liberia and Sierra Leone this year. The virus is also killing chimps and gorillas. Now, scientists who've been working to develop a vaccine specifically for the apes say their research is threatened by a United States decision to end testing on chimps at a major medical institution. Victoria Gill reports.
And my samples are in these big cases right here, straight from Africa. It's been centrifuged down, so it's just a sort
of... Dr. Peter Walsh from the University of Cambridge pulls a box of sample tubes containing gorilla fecal matter from a freezer in his lab.
And it's also got pathogen DNA.
He's studying these samples in an effort to diagnose and combat diseases threatening our closest and most endangered primate relatives. One of these diseases has been called the most terrifying on Earth.
A lab in France has confirmed the Ebola virus as the source, a disease which has no known cure.
More than 300 people have now died in West Africa's latest Ebola outbreak. And conservationists like Dr. Walsh say it's also wiping out the non-human primates in the region.
Ebola virus has killed literally like a third of the gorillas in the world in the last 30 years or so.
His team recently published results from the first trial of a vaccine on chimpanzees to be undertaken for the conservation of the animals rather than for human public health. But he says that vaccines like this one are now stuck because the United States has finally made the decision to end biomedical testing on captive apes.
Before we can use a vaccine in the wild, the park managers in Africa are really adamant it has to be tested on an ape before we use it in the wild. And that means a chimpanzee, a gorilla, or a human. Right now, there's a very strong effort to shut down biomedical testing on chimpanzees in the United States, which is the last developed country that allows it. And if that happens, then, you know, the vaccine trial that we did on an Ebola vaccine may be the last conservation vaccine trial on a chimpanzee.
I don't think it is necessary to keep chimps in primate centers in order to test vaccines. There may actually be a better solution for this.
Beatrice Hahn is professor of medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. She was on an expert group that recommended to the U.S. National Institutes of Health, the NIH, that its remaining research chimpanzees should be retired to sanctuaries.
One should look at the sanctuaries to potentially do such research. First of all, the NIH isn't going to keep chimps around, which are extremely expensive, for the benefit of chimps. That's not their mission. But the sanctuaries keep the chimps for the benefits of the chimps, and some of them may be interested in performing such research.
For apes in sanctuaries to be involved in the testing of any vaccine, though, the law in the US would have to change. The Chimp Act, established in the year 2000, states that no chimpanzee in a US federal sanctuary can participate in invasive research. So an animal cannot be injected or have its blood drawn unless it's for its own veterinary care. But Professor Hahn says that the prospect of developing therapies that are specifically for the conservation of wild animals changes the legal landscape. That law, she says, should now be re-examined.
If chimpanzees and gorillas out there in the forest were not endangered, we wouldn't be talking about it.
That's what we're testing. So that has gorilla cells, and it also has pathogens if they're infected by something. It has the cells, the pathogen, if it's a viral RNA. Right.
Ebola is just RNA, one of the diseases that wild gorillas and chimps face. Ironically, conservation tourism programs that have done so much to help the animals mean that common respiratory diseases like measles are often passed from humans to animals.
Look, Charles, before I show you examples, these are from a sample.
The discussion is just beginning about whether and how captive apes could play a part in developing vaccines for wild animals. But what most conservationists agree on is that time is running out.
I'm a conservationist who got into this because I love these animals. I mean, I hate seeing them in a cage. I don't like seeing them in a cage. It bums me out. But the fact is, unless we do this, those animals are going to go extinct in the wild.
That report was from Victoria Gill. Now, the controversial mayor of Toronto, Canada's biggest city, is back. Rob Ford has been away from the limelight for nearly 2 months, spending time at a rehab centre after a series of scandals, including two videos apparently showing him smoking crack cocaine. How do the people of Toronto feel about him returning to work?
I wish the man well. I hope the rehab stint did him well, but I think at this point he should look after himself and call it a day. And I hope his health is good, but I think it's best for him to pack it in and look after himself.
I do hope that he's taken his rehab seriously. Almost in a way, I feel like if you're really taking a rehab seriously, you need more time off work to focus on yourself and your health. So I'm a little dubious, but I wish him well, personally. But I don't wish that he was coming back into the office because I think he's a gigantic distraction to work in City Hall.
I'm really hoping for the best, but I don't think he'll get a second chance. I don't think so. But he's done positive things in this last month, like getting rehabilitation, and that's something positive, though. In the long run, I don't think he has any chances.
The views of some people in Toronto about their mayor being back at work. Well, according to his brother, Doug Ford, the mayor is a changed man.